Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, October 23rd, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. On today's show, California is about to elect a new governor, but where do they stand on health? We talked to a reporter from Kaiser Health News for some insight. Also, the Fresno Bee has spent the last month and a half starting conversations about the Fresno Divide, and we catch up with one of their reporters to find out how that went.
But first, let's turn to health. In our series, Part of the Job, we've looked at how hospitals are trying to reduce the rate of violence and harassment against those who work in healthcare. In this final installment, my co-host Laura Satsui reports that working in one of the highest risk areas of a hospital only adds to the challenge.
Can I get him on the line?
The emergency department of St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno sees anyone who comes through their doors, and that includes patients shopping for opioid prescriptions.
They'll say, but these are prescriptions, these were given to me.
That's Joyce Eden, St. Agnes's emergency services director.
Yes, they were, but now how you're using them isn't to treat pain. You're actually now using them for the high, for the other feelings that you get.
And sometimes, she says, things escalate.
We actually have to call Fresno Police Department periodically. We have to notify security because when we let them know we are not able to refill their Norco or other opioid prescriptions that they have, we do get threatened and we have to take all threats seriously.
Dealing with threats is one part of the job, but she does more than that.
I'm watching for patients or visitors who might be acting in a way that is of concern, and I will get somebody to screen that, or I'll screen it. Nurses and physicians will tell you that all the time. You might look perfectly fine, but something inside me is telling me no, it's not, and then we keep digging until we get to that answer.
Matt Thomas, St. Agnes's environmental safety officer, says all of the hospital's employees get violence prevention and awareness training, but those who work in the ER get more.
They see the most instances of violence within their positions. They are required to take what we call CPI training, crisis prevention training, and that's verbal de-escalation techniques, awareness, and it's in a classroom setting where they work with our CPI instructors from the hospital.
And the rate of incidents has increased. Eden says there are a few reasons for this. Mental health services have shrunk. This means people seeking psychiatric treatment sometimes come to the ER. It's the same for people who don't have insurance or primary care. And more people coming through the ER means a higher risk of incidents. In response, the hospital has been testing ways to make the department more efficient.
So one of the things that they studied was the times of day when that waiting room gets really busy and about how many people could the waiting room tolerate. So we initially used to only have one triage desk. If we get past a certain wait time in the lobby, then we'll activate a second triage team. Because if we can get those triages done and figure out what level of care they need, then we can keep that volume in the lobby down and the wait time to figure that out.
Eden says her background has uniquely prepared her for a job like this.
I was born in West Africa. And in fact, one of the really fun things about my career and my life is I think it's important to know how to do things with very little, because then you honor when you have a lot. And sometimes you don't have a lot, and then you can learn how to still safely do things even when you don't have all the latest technology and all the best supplies.
Eden says it's this resourcefulness, along with help from her colleagues, that makes it possible to work in the place that's ready and waiting, literally, for the next emergency. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
That story was produced through USC's Center for Health Journalism California Fellowship.
The term public charge is a phrase used by the government to describe undocumented immigrants who rely on or are likely to rely on federal assistance. A recent proposal by the Trump administration would widen the scope of the kind of aid that falls under the public charge. And as reporter Monica Velez tells us, that could make it harder for immigrants to gain legal status.
We start beginning of the line with the milk, two milks, so that'll give you Saturday and Sunday milk.
Terry Pedraza is assembling bags of food for children to bring home for the weekend. She's a volunteer at Foodlink for Tulare County. But she says kids don't just go hungry on the weekends. She knows, because her own son always asks to bring extra burritos in his school lunch.
One day he said, Mom, can you make like six? You eating six burritos now? He says, no, I offer to my friends. And some of my friends, they don't even get any free lunch. You know, they have to pay for their lunch. So I started, my burritos went from 3, 6 to a dozen.
We run across this all the time. The people that are picking the food and packing the food and, you know, processing the food can't eat the food, can't afford the food. It's a sad, sad kind of irony.
That's Nicole Celaya. She's a food system director at Foodlink. She says the demand for food here could get worse. That's because safety net programs like SNAP, that's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps, would be added to the public charge if the Trump administration proposal passes.
We're already serving, you know, hundreds of thousands of families per year. If people are afraid to use SNAP, afraid to access those benefits, then it's going to put more of a strain on us because they're going to be coming to us for these food resources.
Take Lourdes Santiago. She lives in Farmersville with her husband, two kids, and lots of dogs. She goes to Foodlink to make ends meet.
At the end of the month, they kind of stretch out the vegetables or whatever they're giving. That usually helps me a lot.
Santiago is the only one in her family who isn't a U.S. citizen. She is in the process of becoming one. But even so, she and her family are advised not to use any type of federal assistance, like food stamps or Medi-Cal.
We have been told by our lawyer that any type of help like that would hurt our chances of me becoming legal. So we don't seek that kind of help because of that reason.
Her lawyer's advice is sound. That's because the Trump administration wants new and aspiring citizens like Santiago to be self-reliant rather than depend on government assistance. The chairman at the Fresno County Republican Party agrees. Fred Vanderhoof says the country can't afford to support everyone. And if people do receive government aid, it should only be temporary. Vienna Barnes is the deputy director for Tulare Works at the Health and Human Services Agency. She says more than half of the people in Tulare County use some type of assistance, like Medi-Cal, food stamps, or CalWORKS. CalWORKS provides eligible families with cash aid.
Anywhere from your children up to your seniors are going to suffer. They're barely right now, that population is barely being able to make ends meet. And so now we're taking away assistance, and I see where you could maybe homeless increases. They're not going to be able to put food on the tables. They're not going to be able to get health care, so you have a sicker community. And I see that can have a tremendous effect on our community and our state as a whole.
In California, undocumented kids are eligible for Medi-Cal, and so are adults, but only in emergency situations. Michelle Kiyogi represents the California Academy of Family Physicians. She's a family doctor in Bakersfield. She says people may stop seeking services like Medi-Cal if the proposal becomes a reality.
This is just one example of many ways that the federal government is trying to undermine progressive values, but California has consistently resisted and created our own vision for the future and what just compassionate care needs to look like.
Lots of onions, sweet potatoes, regular potatoes.
Back at Foodlink, Celaya is worried families will be faced with difficult choices.
You know, it's basically a choice between daily needs and then the need to keep your family together for the long term. You know, if you're actively working to do it the right way and to get in line like people ask, but then all of these things are working against you, not to mention the cost already and the time that it takes to become a naturalized citizen. This, on top of everything, is just going to make it harder.
And she says food demands can't be met solely by volunteer services like hers. That's why government services like SNAP exist. The proposal is posted on the Federal Register website. People can comment on it until December 10th. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
Thank you.
As we approach the midterm elections, we wanted to examine the health platforms of some of California's highest profile candidates, the two men running for governor. There's Gavin Newsom, currently the state's Democratic lieutenant governor, and the former mayor of San Francisco, who's currently favored to win the election. Then there's Republican John Cox, a businessman and a former presidential candidate in Southern California. What health goals are they making, and how likely are they to keep their promises? FM 89 health reporter Carrie Klein discussed these questions with Samantha Young, a California politics correspondent at Kaiser Health News and California Healthline.
Samantha, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me today.
So let's start with Gavin Newsom. He's long made universal health care a part of his platform. How did he incorporate that into his tenure as mayor of San Francisco?
That's right. Mr. Newsom has been a big advocate of universal health care, and he made national headlines back in 2006 when he was mayor of San Francisco, when he signed into law what is known as Healthy San Francisco. It's the city's universal health care program. He initially wasn't a huge fan as it was going through the process in San Francisco. But he signed on to it, and that's where he's really made a name for himself on healthcare and promoting that program and trying to say that that would be something that would benefit all Californians.
And what came out of that program in San Francisco?
It's the city's universal healthcare program, and that's different than single payer, which you hear that term kicked around a lot in the news. And single payer is a government-run healthcare system. Healthy San Francisco program is more like a universal healthcare program where anybody who lives in San Francisco can go and get healthcare at any of the San Francisco like hospitals, clinics. Just makes sure that if you have a need for a doctor, you can go and see one for free, regardless of your immigration status in San Francisco. You just have to be a resident of the city.
Okay, so he was responsible for some efforts toward universal health care in San Francisco starting over a decade ago. And of course, that's different from single payer. But as you said, he's also been a proponent, at least vocally, of single payer health care. So is it likely he'd be able to act on that at all as governor?
That's the big question that everybody is looking to see. There's a really big price tag involved with providing healthcare coverage, whether you're talking about universal healthcare or going directly with a single payer system. Mr. Newsom, yes, you're right. On his website, he has, and on the campaign trail, he has talked about how he supports a single payer system. But he's kind of backtracked a little bit in recent months. I think he realizes just how expensive that kind of a system would be and just how difficult it would be to get that implemented both through the state legislature, and you would need waivers from the federal government, which, as we know, is with the Trump administration might not look so favorably on that kind of a system for California. So I think the approach for Mr. Newsom and other Democrats in the legislature whose end goal is universal health care or a single payer system is to go more incrementally on trying to expand coverage to other groups of people in California. So I think we're going to see more of a slow approach.
So he would really need to have buy-in from a lot of different parties here, including the federal government. So he's sort of taking a much more slow approach here with that.
That's correct.
And so then let's shift to John Cox a little bit. So his health platform is a lot more squishy. In fact, he's got only five sentences about healthcare on his website. What do we know about his health agenda?
Well, what we know about Mr. Cox is that he believes very strongly in limited government and personal responsibility. And that extends to healthcare. So he believes that government-run healthcare would be disastrous is the word he's used in interviews to describe it. And instead, he wants more of what he calls a competitive marketplace, where he says prices on healthcare services, drugs, the whole gamut of healthcare could be controlled through competition. He's a businessman. He believes in free enterprise. And that's the system he thinks will work for healthcare. And he says that's one way that you would bring down costs and make healthcare more affordable. But beyond that, he hasn't really offered any specifics.
And Cox, of course, has been endorsed by many other Republican lawmakers, including President Donald Trump. Does it seem like he's espoused any specific health care related policies, or is he just generally kind of aligned with the Republican Party?
He's very much aligned with the conservative values of the Republican Party, and he's not ashamed to say that. He describes himself as a Jack Kemp Republican. He believes in lower taxes, smaller government, free enterprise, and he definitely, that transcends to his health care. Like President Trump and congressional Republicans, he's criticized the Affordable Care Act's reach, and he has said that he wouldn't necessarily defend it if he was elected California governor.
Very interesting. And then so let's talk about a specific issue here. I mean, a big part of healthcare in the last few years in California has been extending care to some groups of undocumented immigrants, namely children and some adults with medical emergencies. What's at stake for them with either of these candidates? Is it possible that there'd be, a rollback of any of their coverage or an extension to cover more undocumented California residents?
There's a lot of stake for undocumented immigrants. There were some bills in the legislature this year that tried to address the issue. And so whoever gets into the governor's office could decide whether these groups of people will get health care insurance if these bills come back again in the legislature, which we expect them to. The Healthy San Francisco program that we talked about earlier, that covers all city residents regardless of their immigration status. And so it's something that Mr. Newsom has pointed to as a goal for the state as well. And he would like to see everybody covered. He believes health care is a right. On the other side, Mr. Cox was very critical of the bills that were going through the legislature this year that would have given health insurance coverage to undocumented adults in California.
And of course, we're talking about the governor's race because it's so high profile. Gavin Newsom, John Cox have become relatively household names around California. But when it comes down to it, how important is the governor anyway when it comes to health?
It's a great question. And the governor is important. He's got the bully pulpit. He's the one that's going to sign any health care bill that comes to his desk. But those bills do have to go through the legislature. And, all attempts in the past at universal health care coverage have been stalled because of the big price tag. And that's just something that lawmakers haven't been willing to stomach. And so it'll be interesting to see how they navigate that in this next session with whoever is governor. I think that most healthcare experts agree that California just isn't ready to enact universal healthcare. But they are going to slowly chip away at it and possibly bring more people into the healthcare system who don't have coverage right now. So it's going to be really interesting to watch.
So it sounds like for anyone who is interested in following health platforms and is interested in that's a major issue for them in these elections, maybe they should be looking at their own local candidates in addition to just the governor candidacy.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, well, Samantha Young is a California politics correspondent with Kaiser Health News and California Healthline. Samantha, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me today.
There's a divide in Fresno. The north part of the city, the area above Shaw Avenue, has more parks, better schools. And the meat rendering plant? It's in southwest Fresno. In partnership with Arizona State University's NewsCo lab to improve transparency in journalism, the Fresno Bee has been getting people from all parts of the city to talk about these concerns. On Saturday, the effort culminated in a forum at Fresno City College. I spoke with three of the attendees after the event, as well as the reporter who wrote the Fresno Divide stories. Here's what they had to say.
My name is Rodney Murphy. I learned that the history of this divide started a long time ago, well before I was even born. And so to see how that divide took shape with the building the Freeway 99, how that depleted some of the resources in West Fresno, and to see the migration of major health centers going north, starting as early as the 1930s was very eye-opening for me.
And you said you lived north of Shaw, even though now you live south of Shaw. What was your experience living north of Shaw?
The neighborhoods were nice and everything, but the neighbors weren't too inviting. the surrounding areas had all the walkways and bike lanes and everything, and the neighborhood would seem safe. But being an African-American family in that neighborhood, I sort of had a concern for my children. What if they were walking home and they were, if they were misunderstood, or if they were thought of as, or if they were stereotyped and approached by neighbors or polices, or, and so I started thinking about things like that. And not living in an inviting neighborhood and having children was a concern. And so I moved back south of Shaw. I love Fresno. So hopefully we could mend the fences and heal old wounds, encourage each other to do better and help each other do better, and redirect some resources back to south of Shaw. And once we sort of, start operating from a resource or a growth mindset perspective instead of this deficit perspective that have plagued south of Shaw so long, we have a very diverse city, and I think we need to celebrate that diversity.
My name is Lori Clanton. I tell you, I'm participating in this because I believe that the more people are informed about Fresno, the more they can be part of the health of our city. I'm thrilled that there are so many people filling this room today that really care about Fresno and realize that there's a divide that we can do something about. Also, hearing from people who live in different parts of Fresno about maybe the services that lack in their neighborhoods or the poor conditions, that's not right. And we want to wrap our arms really around the whole city and try to right the wrongs of the past. So I'm glad I'm in a room that was full of people today. That gives me such hope. I hope meetings like this really spark ideas in all of people in throughout Fresno to reach into quadrants of Fresno that they're not familiar with. What I see happening is all of these conversations going into dining rooms all over Fresno. So this becomes part of the conversation in households where people want to venture out of their neighborhood. If people just decided, let's say a couple times a month, they're going to go to a restaurant that is outside of their normal routine. If I live in northeast Fresno, I'm going to go to a restaurant in southwest Fresno and just start getting out of our comfort zones. People who attend church, find a church on the other side of town and decide once in a while to go to a church and get to know people from different neighborhoods.
My name is Eric Payne. I'm here because I'm a resident in southwest Fresno, and I want people to understand what my lived experience is coming from an impoverished community. Historically, there has been huge disinvestment by public agencies and institutions in southwest Fresno, and that if we're going to improve the quality of life for everyone, we need to start at the bottom by making significant investments in our parks, in public safety, and in our quality of housing. I think this is an amazing initiative that the Fresno Bee has taken on to be a convener of this conversation, because they have a very captive audience that is educating themselves on what the issues are that impact our communities. And I think when you begin to create a cross-segment conversation, communities begin to understand and develop a level of empathy for one another to really begin to move to how we can move forward together to solve these issues. My niece was on one of the panels, and she has a very young family. She lived in West Fresno, and she chose to move her family to Northwest Fresno, where she has access to parks. She feels safer in her community with her children, and there's a better quality of education, better schools that her children can attend.
My name is Brianna Calix, and I work at the Fresno Bee as a reporter. I generally cover City Hall and City Council government-related issues. I think that a lot of the people here recognize and acknowledge that there is a divide and, the impacts of that and the effects of that. But there's definitely people out there who still deny it, and I think that those people are really the ones, I wish we would have gotten them here, and those people would really benefit from something like this. It's a very interesting time for Fresno, and I think that this whole initiative and project just took place like right at the exact right time. And so it'll be interesting to see what follows and what we come up with. We're very mindful of and worked really hard to do to, you know, be really an inclusive, make this project very inclusive. And I mean, it's never going to be perfect. The most we can do is do our best, and definitely open to, you know, new ways to do that and open to suggestions, you know, what kind of outreach we should do to make sure that those diverse groups are included. One thing that we heard a lot up here is, you know, everyone, we've been talking about this since the 70s. And so what's going to be next and what are the solutions? And I really think that it's important to have community members talking about that instead of just, you know, I think politicians should be involved in those conversations and probably have the power to, you know, change things and move things along. But I think it's really important that some of those solutions and ideas come from the community.
Again, you heard from Rodney Murphy, Lori Clanton, Eric Payne, and Fresno Bee reporter Brianna Calix.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. We here at Valley Public Radio cover a 7-county area, which in terms of election coverage is a lot. So to get some perspective, we're talking to Ben Adler, the bureau chief from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. He's been taking a deep dive into some of California's congressional races for their podcast, Keys to the House. And he's with us now to share some of their insights. Ben, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So this podcast kicked off in May before the June primaries, and even before you took over as host. It started out hosted by former Cap Radio reporter Ben Bradford. But you've spent time before that primary and now after looking at trends in some of California's most interesting races. To start out, how, if at all, has the podcast changed? Was there anything in the primaries that surprised you guys for this coverage?
Well, before the primaries, I think the biggest question of all was, well, which candidates were going to make it into the general election? Because under California's top two primary system, the top two finishers in June, regardless of political party, advanced to the November runoff. So in a lot of races, there were these questions of, well, might there be two Democrats in a race? Or more likely, might there be two Republicans? And if so, that would kind of decide these races, kind of, it would have decided these races back in June. But now, as it stands, with one Democrat and one Republican and all of these swing up in the air toss-up districts, it does mean that California, and this is where we get a little corny with the name of the podcast, California could very well hold the keys to the House, because Democrats need 23 seats to recapture the majority in the House of Representatives. They need to pick up 23 seats. And at one point, Democrats thought that 7 seats were up for grabs in California. Now it's looking more like 6 one pretty sure pickup for Democrats, 5 toss-ups, and a couple long shots at this point. Even so, Democrats know they need to capture a significant number of those to speed them off toward that big number of 23 nationwide.
And early in those first few episodes, Ben Bradford covered 2 races in the Central Valley with an episode each. So both Republicans and incumbents, they're Jeff Dunham and David Valadao. And starting out just sort of talking about the themes going on with those races. So starting out with Congressman Jeff Dunham's seat, he's in the 10th District, which is in Modesto's sort of northern Central Valley area. What makes that race so interesting?
Well, you've got a seat that's been competitive the last several election cycles. Jeff Dunham, former state senator here in Sacramento, really someone who tends to fit the district pretty well, got agriculture background, and he has been out there trying to strike what he believes is a moderate, negotiable tone on immigration. He has come out supporting the DACA recipients, but he has also come out and voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act and voted in favor of the Republican tax plan. So on those two areas, he has also kind of tried to meet the needs of loyal Republicans in the district. He's going up against a Democrat, Josh Harder, who is trying to say that Denham is out of touch with the district because of some of those votes. And there's a lot of money that's been raised by both the campaigns and the outside groups. And I'm sure many of your listeners are getting overwhelmed, and our listeners too, because Cap Radio reaches down to the Modesto area, are getting overwhelmed with TV ads and pieces of mail about this race. I think if you were to ask both parties, Democrats and Republicans, they would both say they're somewhat optimistic about winning this race, but they don't know for sure who's going to win. It does seem to be kind of a true toss-up.
Right, yeah. I was checking out some forecasts, and one, Sabato's Crystal Ball says it's a toss-up. I think 538 was saying that it's likely Democrat, so it's, you know, no one's really sure here. But turning to...
I think 538 is basing it specifically on polls. Mm. Cook Political Report, which like Sabato, uses polls as a number of factors, but is not as formulaic. I think 538 is somewhat computer-based,
sure.
and the others are a little more subjective than that. And last I saw in Cook Political Report, it was listed as a toss-up.
Mm. All right, and then turning to David Valadao's race in the 21st District, so that's more of the Southwest Valley, and he represents parts of Kings and Kern County, and in that episode, the discussion was really about the fact that he's a Republican in a majority Democratic and Latino district, and yet right now I think he's fairly likely to win his seat back. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, how does that even work, a Republican in a majority Democratic district?
Because for many years, there have been some Democrats who vote Republican, folks who, you know, maybe older, generally white, generally Democratic, who may have supported President Trump. And then also, you've got a lot of folks who are registered Democrat who are less likely to vote, particularly in non-presidential elections, talking about younger voters, minority voters. So those combine, I think, to give the district a Democratic edge. And of course, it supported Hillary Clinton over President Trump by a significant margin a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. But Valadao, again, talking about someone who knows his district well. And in the primary this year, he basically doubled up his Democratic opponent. And they were the only two candidates on the ballot. In the Denham seat, there were a couple of Democrats and a couple of Republicans, and Republicans combined to outvote Democrats, but it was relatively close to 50-50. In the Valadao seat, Valadao got nearly two-thirds of the vote, and his Democratic challenger, T.J. Cox, got barely over one-third of the vote. And that's just, most observers consider that to be simply too big of a gap for a Democratic candidate to make up from the primary to the general, even though Democrats tend to turn out at higher levels in general elections than primary elections.
So it certainly isn't just seats in the Central Valley you guys are looking at. You just returned from a trip to Southern California, which is where there are a few Republican seats Democrats are putting a lot of work into flipping. That'll be one of your next podcast episodes. But can you give us a few highlights? What can we expect, or what will you be talking about with that?
There are really two core questions that we are looking at as far as the Southern California districts. And we're primarily talking about three in Orange County, currently held by Republican Representatives Dana Rohrabacher and Mimi Walters, and the open seat of retiring Republican Congressman Ed Royce, as well as the Northern Los Angeles County seat held by Congressman Steve Knight, although we did not go up into that area. But I think some of the trends at play in the Knight district are also at play in the Orange County districts that we did visit. So again, two basic questions. Number one, will rebellious Republicans, never Trump Republicans, who are fed up with the president, also decide that they are so fed up with Republicans that they are willing to vote their loyal Republican member of Congress out and make Nancy Pelosi speaker? That can be a hard circle to square, if you will, if you're a longtime Republican voter, who even one who does not like President Trump. The second question we're wondering has to do with these districts that have changing demographics, that are increasingly becoming a little more minority and not necessarily as conservative as they once were. Is that demographic change happening fast enough? And will there be enough of the lower turnout voters who do actually cast ballots this time around? So younger voters, minority voters who are less likely to cast ballots in general, and especially less likely to cast ballots in non-presidential years, will they come out and vote? Again, perhaps because they are so fed up with President Trump. So those are some questions that we're trying to answer. And we you know, anytime you talk to voters, it's anecdotal, so it's not like we have clear answers. I think, though, we found voters on all sides of both of those questions so that whatever the results are, you can see what type of voter will end up carrying the day.
Mm-hmm. And while we've been covering some Central Valley races here, it seems like a lot of people, not just in Fresno or Clovis or in Sacramento even, there are a lot of eyes on Congressman Devin Nunes, who is being challenged by a Democrat newcomer, Andrew Danz. And I think the real question at the bottom of this race and a lot of what we're talking about is a blue wave really coming? Could Nunes be unseated, or kind of looking at other seats, could a well-established incumbent be unseated in general?
So Democrats are certainly hoping they can knock off Devin Nunes, but it really is a super tall task. And it's not just because Nunes has outraised Andrew Janz. Janz himself has raised lots of money, and outside Democratic groups are starting to play because there are a lot of Democrats who are furious with Devin Nunes, and they've been more than willing to donate to these campaigns to take him down. But you're talking about a district that is much less of a swing district than the Denham district or even the Valadao district. This is a reliably Republican district. And so, again, are you going to get folks who do not like Democrats running government and particularly are very much in favor of water policies that Nunes favors, that President Trump favors, and Trump spoke about late last week in Arizona. I believe Nunes was there as well, along with some of the other Republican members of Congress, including Denham, and I think Valadao as well. So, are Republicans in the Nunes district willing to vote him out? And it's going to be a real tall task for Democrats to get that done. I think most political observers think it's a long shot. So I'm not sure a blue wave will cover it. Possibly not even a blue tsunami. You need whatever the metaphorical equivalent of whatever comes after a tsunami that would need to happen to take down Nunes. On the other hand, every wave election, there's always one or two members of Congress somewhere in the nation who do not expect to lose, and they do lose. And so, obviously, you never know, and that's why there are elections.
Have you guys talked about, or will you also be tackling, how much the national climate and the conversation about all sorts of things being, you know, Brett Kavanaugh and Trump's policies, how are those impacting candidates? Is that a topic par for the course for this podcast still, or is there no time?
When we were down in Orange County last week, a lot of voters brought up Brett Kavanaugh and his Supreme Court nomination all by themselves. We didn't necessarily have to prompt them. So it is an issue on the minds of voters in both parties. And generally, it breaks down along whether you support President Trump or not. So whether you're a Democrat or Republican who supports President Trump, you're pretty good with the Kavanaugh pick. If you're a Democrat or a Republican or independent, of course, who dislikes President Trump, you did not like how the Kavanaugh nomination was handled. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. But we have been speaking with Ben Adler from Capital Public Radio. He is the Capital Bureau Chief and host of Keys to the House, which is their podcast about California's congressional races. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And we've been talking about how the outcome of some of those races might have a big impact on the House of Representatives. Ben, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Active Measures is a documentary film that explores the history of Russian interference in elections, including the 2016 U.S. presidential election. It's now playing in swing districts across the country, with a one-night run this Saturday in Clovis. I recently caught up with the film's writer-director, Marley Clements. What was your role in the making of this film?
My title was writer-producer, and so I helped to do a lot of the research and craft the narrative and then sort of choose the people that we would be interviewing and make contact with them, ask them to do the interview. I did some of the interviews myself. Jack Bryan, the director, did most of them. And then once we were in the edit, I sort of helped choose what we would include and craft the narrative.
29 people appear in the film. Can you give us a list of some of the people that the audience would see?
Sure. So we interviewed Hillary Clinton, Senator John McCain. We interviewed the former president of Estonia, the former president of Georgia, the former CIA director James Woolsey, a couple former FBI people, several diplomats, and a bunch of academics.
So the film came out in August, but now it's screening again in 15 swing districts in the U.S., including California's 22nd congressional district. What
Correct.
Do you hope the audience will take away from this?
I think we hope that they're able to see that, you know, democracies are fragile and that it's very important to go vote and make their voices heard this November, and that democracy is really under attack around the globe. This is not a uniquely American problem. It's happening all over Europe, and it's really scary. We're seeing the rise of authoritarian leaders in a way that we haven't in almost half a century. So,
Active Measures has partnered with Stand Up Republic to screen the film in swing districts. What is Stand Up Republic, and why the partnership?
Yeah, sure. We're super excited to be partnering with Stand Up Republic. It is the organization that was founded by Mindy Finn and Evan McMullen, who ran independent presidential candidates in 2016. It is their organization that concentrates on defending American democracy and the fundamental principles that have sort of made this country the home of liberty and a source of hope for many around the world. And so their concentration is defending democratic ideals, norms, and institutions, and that really fit with our mission statement of the film. And so we are very excited to be partnering with them, especially because they are a very conservative organization, and it makes this a really bipartisan effort. So we're really excited about it.
And the film is called Active Measures. Can you explain the phrase Active Measures?
Active Measures is a Soviet term that really refers to the campaigns that were launched by the Soviets to attack democracy and democratic institutions. So it's the idea of sowing, it's sort of a hybrid warfare. It's sowing doubt and creating chaos and undermining institutions in other countries. It was a KGB tactic that has really evolved into the 21st century under Putin's leadership, as Putin was a KGB officer, to fit within the 21st century technology sphere. And so with the rise of social media and being able to be in this global world we're living in, it's made it much easier for them to sow doubt and create chaos and attack institutions, because they're able to, you know, feign identities of people all over the world and make false claims and build communities in places where they're not.
So in other words, Russian interference isn't just about the 2016 election.
Absolutely not. It's happening around the world. It continues to happen here in the U.S. today. And we saw it in the Brexit referendum. We see it in, you know, Austria, Italy, Germany, France, all over the world right now. And it's a real problem. And we need to really get back to our, you know, transatlantic alliances that have kept us safe for so many years and fight this. It's really important, and we're seeing a lot of countries, you know, become semi-state capture to the Russians and to these campaigns.
And in making this film, what did you learn that really surprised you?
You know, there's a couple things that I learned, and one of them I would say is just how global this really is and how closely these attacks have mirrored each other. I mean, these are the exact same playbooks, and they're used over and over again.
Can you give us an example of another country that where Russia has intervened?
The countries we focus on in the film are Ukraine, Estonia, and Georgia. Ukraine is a very good example. And you saw in the 2004 elections there, which became the Orange Revolution. We focus a lot on that in the film, because you see a lot of the same tactics that they were using at that point in the American system now. And, I mean, currently, we certainly saw these same attacks on Macron's election in France. We're seeing them in Germany now, the rise of the AfD party, and really throughout the globe. They're really happening everywhere.
One review said the filmmakers craft a compelling and alarming case for the role of Russian interference in the 2016 election, as well as other elections around the world, which you were just referring to. The film takes a lot of information and it disentangles it. What was the process of putting this film together?
Well, it was a lot of work, that's for sure. When we first started, my partners and I went into a friend's house in Southern Maryland, and we spent several weeks just going through footage of other elections, other countries where this was happening, reading white papers from think tanks across the globe. And then we also made a list of everybody who was working for the Trump campaign. This was in March 2017, and not a lot was known at that point. And so we made lists of everybody working on these, on his campaign, and we really did a deep dive into their backgrounds. And, you know, you asked what was surprising to us that we learned. It was really very shocking to see how many of these people had been working with Russian interests in the past. I mean, if you look at Paul Manafort was so closely involved with Viktor Yanukovych, who's a Kremlin puppet. You know, we have Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, Rick Gates. There's so many. And a lot of those are sort of the big ones. But a lot of the other ones, you just see that they worked for organizations like, you know, doing lobbying or advising companies like Alpha Bank and Sberbank and Gazprom and, you know, really big Russian companies that because the way that Russia's operated are all under Putin's control. It's a kleptocracy, and these people are, you know, the heads of these organizations are his sort of puppets that are maintaining everything the way that he wants it to be.
And then back to active measures playing in swing districts. What audience are you targeting?
You know, we're targeting center-right, center-left audiences, sort of anybody who, I think right now a problem we're facing in our country is that watching the news every day is like a fire hydrant of water in your face. We are constantly bombarded with absolute craziness. And, you know, part of active measures campaigns is to undermine the authority of our news agencies and the journalists' work. And so people don't really know what to believe anymore. And we really want to put all of this within a larger global historical context for people. I think every day they hear of another tie with Trump and the Russians. I think when you leave this movie, audiences on all sides really will be able to see that these are not unique incidents. These are not one-offs. This is part of a larger campaign to undermine our democratic process, and it goes back a lot further than we thought, and I think that audiences on all political spectrum will be able to see that.
Again, Active Measures will play one night only at United Artists Clovis Movies 8 in Clovis. Thank you, Marley, for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much, Alice. We're really looking forward to being in your community.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. We've brought you stories before about how hard it can be to find the right kind of care for your physical health. It can be just as challenging to find the right care for your mental health. And one Fresno State alumna's latest book is about facing that challenge herself. Sarah Fawn Montgomery is an author and also assistant professor at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. Her latest book is Quite Mad, an American Pharma Memoir. Well, it's about her own experience dealing with anxiety and illness. She also weaves in narratives and research that point out it's certainly a widespread problem and not just her. Today, Sarah Fawn is with us in the studio to talk about her book and experience. Sarah Fawn, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
To start out, Quite Mad is quite personal, as much a memoir as a researched piece of work. What made you want to write so openly about yourself in this way?
For me, I set out to write the kind of book that I desperately needed and wanted as a patient. As a patient who was first diagnosed with anxiety and OCD and PTSD, I wanted other patient narratives to sort of normalize my experience. But I also wanted the research behind my diagnoses and the different medications I was trying. And so for me, I ended up blending the two. So it's my personal story, but also all of this research about the history of mental health care in the United States. And the reason to write so personally is because mental illness is so highly stigmatized. And I think a lot of us feel isolated. We feel disconnected. We feel strange and odd. And so I wanted to sort of share all of that with readers to try to normalize it, to say, you know, what is odd for me is actually not odd for that many of us. It's 1 in 5 Americans in the U.S. has been diagnosed with a mental illness. So it's actually not odd. It has been strange to write very personally and pretty openly. I tend to be a private person in my real life, but on the page, I'll just throw it all out there.
Yeah. And so I guess in a way, was this the book that you wish had been available, you know, 5 years ago?
Yes, absolutely. As a patient, I found there were two kinds of books, because of course I turned to literature to try to make sense of it. There were either patient narratives or there were medical texts, but very rarely did the two interact. And again, as somebody who wanted to hear patient perspective, but also to get that research, I wanted to weave the two together. So when I'm talking about anxiety, when I'm talking about medical sexism or gendered encounters that I had as a patient, I can then turn to research and look at the history of this. You know, we have a long history in the U.S. of diagnosing women at a larger rate, of having very gendered healthcare treatments for women. And the research really helped, again, to sort of normalize my experience, but to point out that it's not just the diagnosis or, you know, the illness itself, but a larger sort of national problem.
In your book, you get into how mental illness is—it's not taken seriously in some ways, depending on what gender you are, but also how mental health and mental illness affects marginalized groups, also by race and sexuality. And sort of in explaining that, you talk about teaching a literature course that explored how women who are clearly struggling are written. What was most interesting about that class and exploring those portrayals with your students?
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough to be able to teach gender studies courses and disability studies courses. What I found the most surprising, or what I always find the most surprising with students or anybody that I talk to about sort of the literature of madness, is how we often want to have a reason for why people are struggling. We want to point to something and say, you know, someone's having anxiety because of this moment, or someone's having depression because of this experience they've had. And while that is true, we also don't know that mental illness is a combination of genetics and environmental factors and triggers factors and all these other things. And so the resistance that students have and the resistance that people have to accepting mental illness as normal, or accepting it as kind of a normal human emotion. Most humans will experience depression, or most humans will experience anxiety at some point in their life. And so that resistance to wanting to claim it, or that sort of insistence that there be some kind of larger reason for it, I always find really interesting.
And I thought what was interesting as well was how you were saying, you know, they're wanting a reason. And then also at the same time, you would talk to your students. You knew your students were struggling with things as well. Did you ever get to a point in the semester where your students were sort of owning up to that in class?
No, which I think is really surprising. My students, I think a lot of students at any university, and I've been fortunate enough to teach in Fresno at the University of Nebraska, and then now out in Massachusetts, and students across the spectrum are struggling with mental health issues. But I find a lot of students, again, that stigma, they don't want to share that. A lot of students don't want to feel like they're using an excuse. A lot of students don't want you to look at them any differently. And so no, while students would write about it in their papers or share it to me personally, very rarely did they connect it to the literature openly in the classroom, usually just on the paper or in office hours.
In the early pages of your book, you talk about how your parents confront you about your anxiety, saying they're also on medication and it's no big deal, but they're insisting it is a big deal and that you should see a doctor. And you expand out on that, and I want to read this line. You say, "The contradiction in what my parents are saying, on one hand, this is expected. On the other hand, something is very wrong, is American. Obsessed with mental health, America labels mental illness both imaginary and epidemic." Can you talk about that sort of that irony or contradiction? And is there a way to break out of that?
Yeah, that's something that I find so fascinating, right? With this idea that we know that mental illness rates are on the rise in this country, especially with things like depression and then anxiety in particular, which has the largest rate of sort of diagnosis for American adults. So we accept that it is part of American culture. We accept that it is part of American life. Yet again, very stigmatized. We don't like to talk about it. We don't like to look at the root causes of it. We have that idea that, you know, you'll go to the doctor, you'll get a prescription, it will be okay. And for some folks it is, but for a lot of folks, it's not. It's sort of ongoing and it's chronic. And so, yeah, I find that contradiction really sort of strange. And what I talk about in the book is the idea that American culture is fascinated by building your, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and building yourself up and creating this, you know, sort of American hardworking life. And mental illness sort of flies in the face of that. Mental illness is debilitating for a lot of folks, and mental illness can seem the opposite of individualistic and rugged. And so I think that that's where that disconnect comes from. Ways to break out of that. Open conversation, right? I mean, the idea that we have to acknowledge mental illness is multifaceted, that we have to acknowledge that mental illness is not something that's easily cured, that it is sort of normal for folks. And then looking at the quality of care we give people, you know, having more open conversations about access to healthcare, access to prescriptions and to therapy and those sorts of things. Yeah.
Has anyone described you as quite mad?
I've been getting some interesting questions on the book tour. I've had a lot of questions after readings and various events of people wanting to find out how mad I am. So questions about, do you hear voices? Do you see things? Which has been interesting, but I do think that they come from a place of curiosity. I think we don't talk very openly about mental health. So when folks are questioning, how mad are you? I think they do just want information and they do just want to know more about the illnesses and the diagnoses themselves.
We've been talking to Fresno State alumna Sarah Fawn Montgomery about her latest book, Quite Mad, an American Pharma Memoir. It's available online through the Ohio State University Press. Sarah Fawn, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download our podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR. And did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. Thanks to my co-host and executive producer, Alice Daniel, and fellow reporters Monica Velez and Carrie Klein. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Dawn Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Laura Sitsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.